Hey, and welcome to the 6 Minute Mile podcast. I'm David LaValle, and our guest today is one of the most entertaining people we've had on the podcast yet. That's probably not surprising, since part of John Bingham's job as a race announcer is to keep runners engaged and happy while being cooped up in a start corral for way too long. John has completed more than 40 marathons himself, and for many years he wrote a hilarious column for Runner's World called No Need for Speed under his nickname, The Penguin. John was the voice of the Rock and Roll Marathon series during their heyday when they brought millions of new runners into the sport. If John's wit and insights don't put a smile on your face, you may just be gripping the handlebars a little too tight. Kick back and prepare to enter a pretense-free zone. Enjoy, and we'll see you out there. Through Rock and Roll, through Competitor Group, you did a bunch of work with Team and Training.
I did. I actually was with Team and Training when the first Rock and Roll started, then I kind of went in with Team and Training, and I was with them for almost 20 years. Yeah, it was a great honor for me to be a spokesperson for Team and Training. But it was the Rock and Rolls. It was, we did Honolulu, we did Alaska, and a bunch of other events. But it worked. The merger between the old Competitor Group or the old Rock and Roll Marathon with Tim Murphy and all that, that was a nice combination.
Yeah. And so, and did you have a personal connection to Team and Training? Is that how you became interested, or they had approached you?
Well, they did approach me, but I had a high school girlfriend that died of leukemia. So I had a soft spot for that. And it was easy, just off the record. I mean, at some point, some other charity approached me and they said, you know, there are other diseases. I thought, well, yeah, okay, fine. But I don't really have a connection to some other disease. It wasn't then I was picking them out at random. It just seemed to work. And I liked the folks and it all made sense. So yeah, it was a really good time for me.
Because I think that they were among the earliest onto this idea of getting entries into races and raising money. Right. Were they for the most part, the first to come up with it?
Tim Murphy and then the head of Team and Training kind of got together. And I don't think it was an immediate happy marriage because he wanted a bunch of, they wanted entry fee and that he didn't want to pay the entire, it was one of those kind of deals. But Tim Murphy was open enough to it. And of course, once it started, then it just went nuts. And then, other diseases came in. I remember walking through Honolulu and, here's arthritis and here's colitis and here's this and here's that. And my boss said, there's just too many diseases out here now. People figured out that was a good way to raise money. I mean, and it worked. Doesn't seem to be working as well now as it did then. I think there's just so many other opportunities to train with groups. I mean, again, if you go back early on, if you were with Team and Training or with arthritis, that's how you train. You train with that group. Now, I mean, everybody's got a group that they can train with, it seems like, with the social media.
So you meaning any run training group, not necessarily another competing charitable organization?
No, you got group. When we lived in Chicago, you got Ed's running group. And so they would train for the Chicago Marathon. And then you got Bobby's training group and they trained for the Chicago Marathon. So you didn't have that sort of one size fits all. You got to do it with a major training program. You could do it with gyms were doing it. And then you'd have six people out there instead of, 200.
So that's interesting because I always thought the main motivation was I can get a bib for one of these sold out marathons. I can't qualify for Boston maybe, and I've tried the New York lottery six times and gone 0-for-6, but here's a way to get a bib. But you're saying a big part of the motivation is that the training group and the plans.
Yeah, I don't think there was a monolith on that. I think that a fair number of the people did have a connection to the disease, particularly in the case of leukemia and lymphoma. And so they had a real passion for raising money and, some friend or some child or some parent. So there was that. That was a part of it. Then I think you're also right that people who maybe couldn't get into the event that they went into. I remember we were talking about London. London, people shop the charities because there's so many more charities. And how much do I have to pay to get into your charity? And then there were others that just wanted the group training experience. They weren't comfortable training on their own. I want to train for Chicago. Oh, look, here's something I can do. It's a good cause. I'm happy to raise the money. And so, yeah, I think there were a number of different reasons why people did it.
That's great. So I want to rewind a little bit and take us through the earliest of the early years, a dark and stormy night in 1973 when you were born. But what, uh,
But 1973, it's trying to
ish, right?
Back to the late 1800s when my the running thing started for the very first Boston. Yeah, that's about it.
No. But what were your earliest, what are your earliest memories about participating in sports? And I know you're very humble about your athletic abilities, and your story about how you came into running is interesting. We'll get to that. But I'm curious, what were you interested in sports as a kid?
Well, it's not hard to be humble when you sucked as bad as I did. You know, really not. And you can't. I don't have very many stories that I could tell about success. No, I mean, I was a kind of a normal kid growing up in Chicago in the 50s and 60s. You know, I bicycled everywhere. That's what it was. And in those days, there was only one sport. It was baseball. That was it. I mean, that's what we played. So summertime was all about getting together with guys and coming up with a game or playing catch or pop, you know, run or fly or whatever that was. So, I mean, I was very interested in that, and I liked it. And I was always the kid that got to play right field, deep right field, because nobody at that age could hit it deep in right field. But I was a part of it. And I think I liked that part, and I liked being associated with the athletes at the time. And so it was an introduction to it, but it was not something that went on. I was a musician. I mean, from the time I was in third grade, I was playing in the band, and that, you know, in those days, you kind of had to choose in school whether you're going to be a band geek or whether you're going to be an athlete. You really couldn't do both. And I had more talent, more musical talent than I ever had athletic ability.
What were your instruments as a musician?
I was a trombone player, and that worked out, I mean, in my case, very well, because I went on to a career, you know, in music, first in the Army band and then freelancing. So I was lucky enough that I could take whatever talent I had, I could massage that into a career. There was no way to massage. Fortunately, I mean, on the running part of it, I was so bad that it was the Bob Uecker thing. I mean, if I had been mediocre, and I've talked about this a lot, if I had been merely mediocre, you know, some sort of like 9 minute, 9:30 mile guy, I wouldn't have had a career at all, because everybody's in kind of that part of it. But if you really are terrible at it and you're happy about being terrible, it resonated with people.
I love it. And now did you go into the Army directly from high school, or did you go to college first?
Went to college, you know, got a degree in music. And then this is 1970, 1971. People were getting drafted, and I was going to get drafted.
You said, I want to go to Vietnam and play the trombone there.
Well, that was, I wouldn't have minded going and play trombone there, but, you know, they reminded me that, you know, if I'm shooting at them, they're shooting at me. And I thought, well, you know, that's not who I am. Yeah. So I was very fortunate. I got into the Army band in DC, which is a permanent duty station. So I stayed stateside the whole time, got to play a lot of fun things in the Washington, DC area. So, yeah, but that's, you know, that the truth is, I enjoyed basic training, talk about the Army, because it was a chance to sort of be physical. I mean, I like the part about being physical and people running around and doing this and, you know, shooting guns and things that I never got a chance to do. But when it was over, I was glad to be in the band.
But this was, you know, this is old school. Even though you're going on to a career as a trombone player in the Army, you still had to go through the normal basic training, right? There wasn't a cushy track that.
Yeah, I went into the Army in 1971. Everybody was in the infantry. That was it. Yeah. And the vast majority of the guys that I was in service with in basic training, you know, they went on to advanced infantry. It was not a great time to be in the Army for anybody, really.
And so what did you think of the running in basic training?
Well, again, I was terrible at it. And the drill sergeants figured out pretty quickly that I was no good at it. So, of course, they made me do more of it.
Oh, no.
You know, this is kind of the way drill sergeants go at things, right? You know, you're slow and you look like you're really suffering. So you run ahead and make sure that there's nobody coming down that street. So in a way, they probably helped me, because at least I was getting more training than I would have otherwise.
Now, did you have any interest that once basic training was over, did you have an interest in continuing running at that point in your life?
No. And clearly you had never had a very large drill sergeant screaming at you 24
hours a day
for 12 weeks. Because when that was over, no, the last thing I wanted to do was run. I had no interest in running. And of course, you know, your career, like anybody else, your career gets started. You kind of invest in that career. I had a child about that time. So you're investing in the marriage and the children and all that kind of thing. So no, running was I was never interested in running. I mean, that's the sort of crazy part about the career I've had, is that I didn't have a passion for it. I didn't have even an interest in it.
And so take us to the point I know we're probably going to fast forward over a few years of your life story here, but take us to the point where you decided that running ought to be something you'd try again.
Well, you're fast forwarding over all of the drinking. That's probably just as well. We'll kind of get to the end of the drinking stage. And because I was actually pretty talented at that. If there had been like an Olympic drinking contest, I probably could have gotten involved.
The beer mile, man. It's just, you know, if only the beer mile had been invented 20 years earlier, you that's that right. would have been your path to glory.
I probably could have done that. You know, I probably would. Anyway, you know, my career was going on. Actually, I stopped being a full-time musician, and I was in music administration. I was at the University of Illinois for a while, and I was at Oberlin College as the associate dean. So, I mean, I was having a fair career as a university administrator. And I mean, the short story is I had an employee who was a bicyclist, and he made about half the money I made, and he was happier than I've ever been. And I thought, well, that pisses me off. It doesn't sound right. And he was a bicyclist. And so he turned me on to bicycling, and I did some bicycling because I remember enjoying that as a child. And that one thing led to another, and I was on a trip, a recruiting trip, and I bought a pair of running shoes and tried that, and that seemed to work out pretty well. And so I fell in love really with the motion of it all, not with the activity of it all, certainly not with the competition part of it all. But again, I'm a motorcyclist from a long time ago. I like the motion part. I like the motion part of the bicycle. I like the motion part of the motorcycling. And when I discovered that if all I focused on was the motion part of running, not how fast I was going, not how far I was going, but just I was actually moving by myself with my own 2 feet, I dug that. I mean, I liked that part.
Yeah.
And you know, the story is that my first run, I went down my driveway and I ran as far as I could possibly think about running. I was completely and totally out of breath. And I turned around and I could still see my house. So, I mean, that was, but, and this is important. I showed signs that very first day of having a runner's mentality, because I made my way back to my garage and I got in my car and I measured how far I had gone.
So I like that.
So there was still that little part
something
of that
there
inside of me that said, yeah, I need to know how far I went. This is before Garmin's and all of the kind of,
sure.
You just had, it had an 8-lap Timex Ironman, which I just thought was the coolest thing ever.
Yeah.
So that was it. It just started very simply, and it started really the way it continued, which was not being the least bit interested in time, not being, you know, distance was part of it. Cause if you're going to do a 5K, you kind of got to do 5Ks.
Yeah.
You know, somebody would come, you'd see somebody come across the line at a 5K and they'd come across in, you know, 14 minutes and just be angry and screaming and hollering. Oh my God, I missed my PR by 35 seconds. And I'd come across in 45 minutes, like, look at me, dude, I'm having so much fun. And so even from the beginning, it was, I guess I wasn't really smart enough to understand that the running community required me to care about how fast I was going. And it just went completely over my head.
So about how old were you when you did that now apocryphal garage run?
Early 40s, 41, 42, somewhere in that area. Yeah.
And you were still kind of smoking and drinking at that point?
Yes, I was.
Yes, I was.
Well, now, since you brought that up, you know, I'd smoked for 25 years. I quit smoking because I thought I should try to get faster at a 5K. And I thought, you know, smoking a pack and a half of cigarettes, this is probably not the best way to go. So I did begin to make that kind of transformation from a very sedentary lifestyle of overeating and drinking and smoking to where, okay, I'm having a lot of fun with this, I think I could have more fun if I changed my life to a more active lifestyle. And that was really sort of the beginning of what has become the rest of my life.
And were there any outside motivations? Do you think about, you know, kids or wife or an uncle who died young or something?
No, just wanting to be happier than this goofy bicycle employee of mine. I mean, if I was going to make more money than him, I figured I should have been happy. And the joy came then. Like I said, then you become a part of the running community. Then you meet other people who have common interests, shared interests. There was another faculty member who was every bit as slow as I was, who was having a great time. So we kind of buddied up and we'd do these races and we'd absolutely finish last with giggling all the time. And the story I tell is that we were out at a duathlon and the ambulance was behind us, literally behind us. And we could hear them on the radio, you know, are they still out there? Yeah, there they are. But we didn't care. I mean, we just were having so much fun. And as I've said, the beauty of this for me was that you could start and finish in the same day, right? I mean, you could start a 5-day. Now, if you're in your early 40s and you've had mortgages and two marriages and you've had all these kind of things, there doesn't ever seem to be any end to anything, right? It's just going to go on. You're going to pay your mortgage forever. You're going to have a 60-month car payment. But I can start a 5K and even 45 minutes later, I'm done. And so that to me was the other part of it that was attractive, is that I could prepare for it. I could train. I could get up. I could do it. I could get it over with. And I would have been successful in completing something.
So how did you go from there? Now you're in an academic setting, right? So people were examining their lives probably, right? And being sort of mindful about what their purpose was in the world. But how did you go from there, having some fun, having some laughs, doing a 5K, to deciding you wanted to write about this, chronicle it, share it?
I never decided I wanted to write about it. There was a group in those days, if you're old enough, and David maybe, called the Dead Runner Society. The Dead Runner Society was a mail, it wasn't Facebook or anything like that. It was just a mail program, an email program.
And I do not remember that. Okay.
Oh, Dead Runner Society. I think they still exist. So somehow I got invited to be a part of this Dead Runner Society. And what they would do is, it was like a mail thing. And so people would post about their runs. So I ran 3 miles today. It was awful. It was rainy. I hated it. I can't stand running. And then I would get on there and say, I ran 3 miles today. Holy smokes, was this a good time? Yeah. So people began to encourage me to do that on this email list. And a friend of mine then took just one of those emails and sent it to Runner's World Magazine. This is in the fall of 1995, sent it to Andy Burfoot, because in those days, they had a final page of Runner's World was subscriber comments or something like that.
Right.
So she sent it into Runner's World, and a day or two later, or whenever it happened, I get a call from Andy Burfoot, who was then the editor of Runner's World Magazine. And I thought, oh, shoot, my subscription has elapsed,
Yeah, my credit card bounced. Yeah.
And he said, we got this email, we read the thing, and it was actually the first Chronicle thing that I did. And he said, it was really interesting, and we think that we might want to have you write 8 columns for Runner's World.
Eight
columns. Now, I was a freelance musician. If somebody says, can you do 8 columns? Of course I can. Yes, of course.
Yes.
Right. No idea what that meant. The subtext on that is, Ambie's wife, Christina, had gotten that mail from before she shared it with Ambie. And she had sent me a very nice letter saying, essentially, nobody cares about a former fat guy, smoker, drinker running slow. So here you got this. Can you imagine that supper? Hey, Ambie, I just hired a new guy to come write for Runner's World. And Christine, yeah, I just told some idiot, don't even bother us anymore. Yeah.
So that was it. Same guy.
So he wanted 8 columns. Being a freelance musician, not having any idea about journalism, I wrote 8 columns. I just sat down and wrote 8 columns and I sent them all in. And that was the last I thought of it. I thought I'll have these 8 things on my wall at some point and I'll be able to tell my grandkids I wrote for Runner's World.
But they give you some parameters. It's got to be 450 words to 500 words. And
well, in publishing in those days, it was all about characters and it was 3,300 characters, 750 words, basically.
Okay.
So I would just, write them all out and send them all in and that was fine. And about, September of that year, Andy called back and said, we'd like to get 12 more columns. Why? He said, well, because there was something in that voice that was resonating with what was then the very beginnings of that sort of second running boom.
Yeah.
We've been through the Jim Fix and of course, Frank Shorter, the great Frank Shorter and all those guys. But there was just this beginning of a slower, older, what we call the second running boom. And Sheehan, the greatest writer of all time, didn't really address them. What galvanizes it is that you do your very best and you try really hard and you get to the finish line, and you puke and you fall through it, that.
Right.
And I was like, hey, let's just get it done. Let's have fun with the whole thing. So that led to the second year of writing for Runner's World. And of course, by then we're off, literally off to the races.
And so how was Ambi getting feedback from readers or people sending in emails saying, hey, I don't know who this guy is in the back page, but he's pretty good.
Two things were happening. George Hirsch, the publisher's wife, mm-hmm. was liked the column. She liked the Penguin voice. So there was this sort of, wine over dinner. This kid's got some kind of, we think this is going to work. And then they were also getting, feedback on it that, hey, because Sheehan had died about a year earlier. And I'm not trying to replace Sheehan. but there was a kind of an opening for a personality columnist. You know, I mean, people were writing, Joe Henderson was writing Joe Henderson kind of stuff, and Hal Higdon was writing Hal Higdon.
Right.
And I was writing kind of lifestyle kind of things. And so there was a gap in their journalism and their whole, all their pages. And one of the reasons why, well, two things that were, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, is that my column was not in the front with the columnists. If you think about Runner's World in those days,
sure.
Now you had Henderson and Higdon and all those guys, and they had their picture there and they were all in the front of the magazine. Well, somehow they thought, you're the slow guy. We're going to put you in the back of the magazine.
I like so that.
The next to the last page was always where I turned up. And more importantly, I think they never put my picture in there. And that was whoever decided that, that was genius, because Hal Higdon got older, Joe Henderson got older, Jack Galway got older, but the Penguin never got older.
I like that.
Always 43 years old. The Penguin had always been running for about 6 months, and the Penguin was always having a good time being that guy. So as I got older, you know, the disparity between what the Penguin was experiencing and what John was experiencing just got wider and wider and wider. So in an interesting way, I had to learn how to write to the character. It was like being Captain Kangaroo. You know, I had to put on that Penguin character and write as if I was 43, had been running for 6 months, when in fact, you know, I'm now 55 and I've done 45 marathons. It's kind of a different thing. So the challenge, that was the challenge really, was to find ways of continuing to speak to the people who were just starting out, who were running for only 6 months. We're having those experiences that I had 6 months into my running career, and not start talking about, well, yeah, you know, when I did the Marine Corps marathon and I got, nobody wanted to hear about that. They wanted right. to hear about things that resonated with their beginning running lives. And most of them were, you know, in their, like I was, late 30s, early 40s, trying to get a healthier, active lifestyle.
And so what was your source of inspiration? Because you had to come up with dozens and dozens and dozens of column ideas.
Simple. People. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the columns, you'll see that they're almost invariably about somebody or about some experience I had with somebody. And that's, you know, that's why part of the reasons I was out there doing so many races is that that's where you get that feedback. And then you would start to see, oh, okay, this sounds like it's only about Eddie, but in fact, there's some universal truth to what he's experiencing. So the goal was then to write to that universal truth, and then people would understand it better. So that's, yeah, it was very, very easy. Because now this was back 96, 97, 98, in the early 2000s. I only had to come up with 12 ideas a year.
Yeah,
now,
right.
Write a guide, but I can come up with 12 ideas a year. And so, and in the early days, I did the same thing I did at first. I would send, in this case, Mark Wilweber, I would send him all 12 columns. And my idea with the arc was like an album, an old vinyl album, where you had an early stages and I would have the early months, and that was typically about new runners and getting new and all this. And then the intermediate months were all about kind of doing things and doing races and what that was all about. And then as you got into that sort of October, November, December, then I would kind of let things sort of calm back down again and be more reflective about the year. So that was the arc. And I talked to Ambie, he said, nobody knows that, you know, but you. And I said, well, it doesn't matter. That's how I construct the year, is using that arc. And it seemed to work.
And so what kind of stuff would they want to pull you into from there? Because it's, I would imagine they were tempted that, hey, this formula works.
Nothing.
All right.
I mean, come on. You know, if you know the guys from Runner's World. And
sure.
No, they didn't even want me around. I mean, it was just because I represented everything that they hated. And the fact that it was popular made it even worse. You know, we would go, in fact, we did Boston one time. We had a pacing group. We did a pacing group in Chicago. And they would introduce, you know, here's Adam B. Okay, that's great. Here's Ambie Burford, Boston Marathon. You know, here's the Penguin. That goes crazy. Yeah,
well, screw you, punk. Not,
yeah. So, no, they didn't try to drag me into anything. If they could have, they would have forced me out of things. And now, as it turns out, they're all wonderful people. Ambie has become a great friend. And,
oh, absolutely.
I mean, I owe him everything. And Adam Bean maybe gave me the best advice. He said, don't try to be Sheehan. You know, Sheehan was Sheehan, and that was fine, but you've got to write to your own voice. Now, again, this is, side story on this one. I'm, like I said, big time motorcyclist, and I wrote, read Cycle World for years and years and years. Peter Egan was one of their columnists, and he would write about motorcycling. And I read his column all the time. And I thought, well, if I can write about running the way Egan writes about motorcycling, which is, again, from a very personal point of view that has some universal appeal, I'll be happy. So Peter Egan actually gave me a 20-year career trying to imitate the way he wrote about motorcycling.
I love it. Did you ever chat with him about that?
I tried. He's a very elusive guy. He lives in Wisconsin, and I lived in Chicago. I just wanted to thank him. And I think he thought I owed him, or he owed me money or something. He's very, very hard to get a hold of. But I know that it's true. So that's
all. Well, there you go. It's that J.D. Salinger persona he's trying to project.
Yes.
So you must have tapped into some earlier writing skills. Did you win the high school English prize when you were in 11th grade?
That's true. I mean, and I get asked this all the time. Well, how did this all start? You must have done poetry in English class. No, absolutely not. Now, when I was in Tennessee at Murfreesboro, there was a giveaway free magazine, or, you know, like a newspaper, tabloidy kind of thing. And this buddy of mine and I started writing a column called The Recess Bell. And it was goofy. It was a giveaway. We didn't get paid. It was nothing. The only reason that helped is that when Amby asked me if I had ever done any writing, I could say yes, because I had, in fact, been doing that for about 3 months. So, but I didn't lie. But there was no, and I've told people, I mean, go out and address students, that the job for which I am the least well qualified is the job that I've had the longest. And so you just never know. You never know. If Amby hadn't called me, that one phone call changed my entire life.
I love it. Now, hopefully he increased your pay every year.
No, not much.
Come on.
No.
Who is your agent?
You cannot put this in whatever you're going to, no, this is going to be the, let me just put it this way. The payment for the column was modest.
Okay.
And every year it became a little less modest, but it never changed. I mean, it never really changed. And then eventually it wasn't a matter of an agent. It just got to the point where I think they were embarrassed that I was getting paid like 1/10 of what every other columnist was getting paid. But I think it was a part of, maybe they thought I would quit if I wasn't making any money, but I had a good job. So it wasn't really like I was trying to make money doing this.
Because those, as you know, those are the glory days of the magazine publishing world, right? And you know, Runner's World made tens of millions of dollars a year in revenue. And the demographic of that readership was off the charts. It was one of the best, you know, really well-educated, reasonably affluent readership demos. So they had the cash to pay you, man.
Now, I think the only probably smart insight that I had in that time was that having a full page in Runner's World every month.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if I had tried to buy that full page ad in Runner's World every month? So there was a compensation there for me that it didn't come in the form of cash, but that led to being invited to speak, and eventually invited to do the rock and roll stuff, because rock and roll started in 1998. So Tim Murphy was aware of that. And so the money, it was like having a one page ad in Runner's World every month. So I took it as that. And didn't worry so much about whether they were going to pay me or not. And because it led to the career, it led to being, like I said, invited to do other things, to get paid to do other things, and eventually ended up with the whole rock and roll series and doing the announcing that paid pretty well.
Yeah. So talk to us about that. So how did that evolve? So you were there in the early days of the rock and roll series, which again was probably the poster child for capitalizing on that second running boom. And you were in the front row on that one.
Something, Runner's World did a pace team in the first rock and roll marathon, 1998.
Okay.
And it was all the heavies, you know, it was Amby and Jeff Galloway. And so we were all up there on stage. And there was something about my joking around or whatever it is, my silliness, that Tim Murphy, the owner then of the event series, Elite Racing, attracted him. It was something about that, because, you know, one of the things that it was a skit that I used to do all the time is we're standing up there and I would tell the audience, I would have the entire audience, I want you to stand up and I want you to turn around, face the back of the room. They would all do that. And I would tell my Runner's World colleagues, you see, this is what a race looks like to me. I'm not the guy in front. So there was something about that that Tim thought was clever. So he invited me back in 1999. And at that time, Suzuki was sponsoring it, and I did a little ride. And so eventually it became it seemed to be a good marriage of whatever I was trying to do and whatever Tim was trying to do. And I think he fought, and whether he was right or not, I don't know. He felt that my presence there attracted the same crowd that he was trying to attract. So there was this kind of symbiotic relationship. And then it turned out to be great. And then Team and Training came in, and then the whole thing was just clicking.
So this became your full-time job then?
Oh yeah, I left the university in 1999 because you know, you're not going to make any money as a state in a state university in Tennessee.
Sure.
People say, well, how could you do that? Oh, I said, I wasn't making any money there. So if I don't make any money here, I'm no worse off, and I'm having a lot of fun. I got a lot of free airfare. So yeah, the ambition was to see if this would work. If you go back to rewind again, when I got out of the Army band, I wanted to see if I could freelance as a trombonist. Could I make a living playing my horn? So I guess this was the same kind of thing. Could I make a living being the Penguin? You know, and maybe Bob, what's his name? You know, Captain Kangaroo, maybe he had to have that same conversation. Can I make a living being this character? As it turns out, yeah, I did.
All right. And so we skipped over how you got the nickname. I'm sorry, you've told the story 1,000 times, but
it's a true story. People like to say that we got a focus group together, you know, we got
right.
People decided, well, you like characters. How do you feel about sloths? You know, how do you feel about
right.
We want to do that.
The color scheme of a penguin, right?
True. I was running in Appleton, Wisconsin with a friend, and I was running down the street in Appleton, Wisconsin. In Appleton, Wisconsin, Gabriel's, this is how true it is, Gabriel's furniture store had a window that was sort of diagonal to the path that I was running onto the sidewalk. And I looked up and I saw this person running in Gabriel's window, wearing black shorts and a white top and going very slowly. And I thought, well, this guy looks like a penguin. Look at that. Look at that. His feet are barely moving. You know, he's taking like 6 inches with every, you know, kind of that Tim Conway walk. And as I got closer and closer, I thought, oh my God, that's me. You know, and I look like the Penguin. So it stuck. It was just one of those things where that first column that I wrote, I talked about, you know, there are gazelles and there are this and there are that, but I said, I'm a penguin. And they're, now that I've been in Antarctica 8 times, you know, they're fun little critters, but it stuck. And there was something about it that wasn't pejorative. And if you talk about being a snail, you know, you're a snail or a sloth or you're this, or you're a turtle and the rabbit, but there was something, again, fresh about the penguin that didn't sound like you sucked, even if you did.
I love it. And did you ever, did you make money off penguin memorabilia? Did you sell coffee mugs and t-shirts? And
well, when my mom was alive, yeah, we would go to the expos, and my mom was a retail person. I mean, you could not buy something for my mother.
Love
so she, yeah, we would have cups and t-shirts and stuff like that. And she would hunt people down and say, look, this is my son. You know, you got to buy. So yeah, we would walk away from an expo with like, you know, $150, and my mom couldn't have been happier. But we never really try to capitalize on that. That wasn't what it is. The capitalization, if you want to kind of move in that direction.
Yeah,
is,
yeah.
In the late 2001, I was living in Chicago at that time, and I was running down the Chicago Lakefront Path, which I'm sure you know.
Absolutely.
And Janet Williams was coming the other way, and I had run the Chicago Distance Classic a number of times. And she said, hey, we're going to get rid of the Chicago Distance Classic. She said, would you like to buy it? Okay, sure. I'm running down. Well, the next week we had lawyers in a room and we were buying. We created a race production company, John Bingham Racing, to buy the Chicago Distance Classic. Now, in those days, nobody knew what anything was worth. So again, musician, I said, tell you what, year one, we'll split the gate in half. Year two, we'll take 60, you take 40. And this is how we're going to buy it. And they said, okay, that's fine. Cause they were trying to get rid of it anyway. So that became the basis for John Bingham Racing. And that, you know, eventually is the thing that really sort of, it was a different dimension. I mean, we were doing the penguin thing, but we were doing it on a grander scale. So our races, for example, you know, they were open, half marathons was open 4.5 hours. That was it. And nothing could be touched. Not a cup of water could be touched, not a cup of Gatorade, the timing, nothing could be touched. Because I made that commitment to the people who were like me, that were going to be out there, that I will support you absolutely, just like you were in the first 10 people, we'll support you on that. And so that it worked. People started to turn up for that. And we also then went the opposite of competitor running, and that is we eliminated the professional field.
Yeah.
And so how can you do that? Well, I got fast kids in Chicago that are trying to build a resume for themselves. And it won't help them very much if they come in 11th after the first 10 Kenyans. Right?
Good point.
I'm going to let my kids get out there. So that brought in that crowd. So suddenly we had everybody understanding, okay, he's not just this penguin idiot that only talks about slow runners. He really understands both the business of running and how to put on an event that really celebrates everybody from the top to the bottom. And so it worked. We went from 2,500 runners the first year we put it on to over 10,000 the seventh year. And we did it by just investing in the running community in Chicago. And then other people sort of came on.
And were you still master of ceremonies, race announcer for all those?
I was always out there in the field. But you got this sort of, it's schizophrenic. Because in one hand, you're the race owner. So every penny that they spend is coming out of your pocket. And I had things that the way I wanted things done. And, the joke was, it's John Bingham Racing and I'm John Bingham. That's why I wanted it. And millennials, I was thinking we could maybe, I didn't ask you that. Put the Gatorade there. Well, put the Gatorade there and stop it. But that's what attracted competitor. When competitor came in and started buying races, the Chicago Distance Classic was, at that point, was a half marathon. And I remember sitting down with Peter and he said, here's the deal. And you can put this in or not put this in, but it was kind of a mafia thing. He said, hey, we're gonna put a half marathon in Chicago. And we're either going to buy you or we're going to buy the Chicago half marathon. And if we buy the Chicago half marathon, we're going to put you out of business.
We're going to crush it. Yeah.
I said, okay, Peter, I'm not that smart, but okay, let's do this. And so they did. They bought the race and it was a fair price for everybody and everybody was happy. And the funny thing, and again, this is kind of all off the record, but we sat down with the forensic accountants, right? Because they want to know how in the world did you make this kind of money? Okay, we get to things like the elite athlete budget. Well, their elite athlete budget for competitor for most of their races were somewhere well over $100,000 by the time they paid them and they got rooms and flights and everything like that. Well, what is your elite athlete budget? It's zero. How can you do zero? I don't pay anybody to come here. They can run it if they want to run it. Then hospitality. Their hospitality budget would be somewhere in the $150,000, $200,000 range because they had their sponsors and they're done. What's your hospitality budget? And I actually knew the exact amount, $242. I said, my mother goes to Dunkin' Donuts. She gets a couple of jugs of coffee and some donut holes. She brings them in and there's no badges. They come up to my mother and they say, hey, I know John, my friend of John's. My mom, oh, you're a friend of John's? Come on in. That was the elite. That was how that all worked. So we went through it all and they just couldn't figure it out. We had no full-time staff and we used volunteers best we can. We paid people to pay. The year that they bought it, they invited me into the first year that they put it on. They invited me in for their big dinner so I could be introduced. They had 91 staff. 91 staff. To put on the same race that we put on with no.
Oh, your very same race. This is not a separate big rock and roll.
Same race. Well, they put on this. They put the Gatorade between mile one and mile one and a half. Okay, then there's another crew. I said, well, that's why you guys aren't making any money. Just too many people. But again, Peter Engelhart and all those guys, they were great to me. They kept me on board on a consulting basis with them for the next 6 years, and so that was great because I still got to be a part of the event. So I just didn't get to be the guy out there driving the forklift.
Yeah. And they wound up building some pretty good, pretty popular media publications, right? So they owned Competitor and Velo News. And so did you ever get involved with that side of the house?
I did. That's why I ended up leaving Runner's World because they were looking at a more comprehensive package. It was contract time. And they said, look, you're already doing the speaking and you're doing this and you're doing that. We're trying to maybe boost the subscription to Competitor Magazine, which at the time was a free giveaway.
Right.
Would you be willing to come over and write for Competitor Magazine? And he was one of those offers you can't refuse.
So
I did. And whether it was the greatest decision I ever made, I don't know. I mean, Runner's World was still at the time at the top of the heap. But I think, it wasn't very many years later that Runner's World was losing that position. And social media was coming in and everybody was going digital. So if it hurt me, I don't think it hurt me that much. But yeah, they were wonderful. Scott Dickey is another name. I mean, he did all the contract negotiation, and we did most of them in the backseat of a taxi. There was never any animosity about it. Well, what do you want to do? I'll do this. What do you want to do? I'll do that. What are you going to pay me? We'd kind of like to pay you this. Well, okay. I mean, there was never acrimony.
Yeah. And so what's your view? So of course the media landscape has changed so much in this industry, right? In this focus area and across everywhere, right? Magazines and print publications are a shadow of what they used to be. What's the winning formula now, in your opinion? What should an endurance media property look like these days?
That is an absolutely fantastic question. And if I had that answer, I would still be writing and speaking and doing everything else. My wife, you know, Jenny Hatfield, Coach Jenny, is still very active in all of that. And she's, you know, does podcasts and all these kind of things. To be honest with you, I don't think I could survive in the current milieu. Because like I said, I had 12 ideas a year. That's all I had to come up with. And then I would go talk and speak. And you know, you come up with a couple of good lines and you share those lines everywhere you go out because it's a new audience. And so it wasn't that difficult for me to come up with a show and to come up with columns. But these people now that are having to write every day, they have to come some creative idea every day. And the volume is, there's so much noise now. You know, if you wanted to know about running in 1996, you bought a copy of Runner's World magazine. If you wanted to know how to run your fastest 5K, you bought a copy of Runner's World magazine. Now you can Google, I want to run my fastest 5K, and you'll get 10,000, you know, Uncle Ernie's 5K training plan. Aunt Betty 5K. Well, and there's no way of discerning which is the good one and which is a not good one, at least with Runner's World. Whether it was true or not, it had the cachet of being in Runner's World. So they wrote it and it was published in Runner's World. You know, Scott Oaks, then it must have been legit. So I think that's the biggest problem is I don't know how anybody distills it down to what's true, what's not true. And I think it's much more difficult to be an expert now because there's so much more information. You know, you used to be able to say, well, you know, Hal Higgins, you got to do one long run in the middle of the week and then you got to build it up. You got to do this. You got to do that. Well, then the Hansons come in and say, well, no, a 16-mile long run is plenty if you're getting ready to do a marathon. Well, right. Wait a minute. Now, Jeff Galloway says you got to do more than 26.
Right. Right.
So all of a sudden now there's this kind of dissonance between, and people, to be honest, don't know what to believe. I didn't know what to believe. You know, I believe Jeff Galloway and that worked for me. So I don't know what I would do now.
Yeah, it's not an obvious answer, right? In any media area, right? And I do think it is. It's really hard for those, the people who thrived in the glory days of print.
Yeah.
To make that full digital transformation or transition.
Thanks for putting me in the category of the old people that in the glory days.
Hey, man,
they won the Super Bowl, right?
I'm probably the only person on this call that waxed all the galleys and put together newspapers by hand. I mean, it was I still love the old school print stuff. But it's hard. It's kind of an easy cheap shot to take to say, oh man, you're old school. You came from the print world. You'll never understand the digital world. I mean, that's not really fair, right? That's obviously a way over generalization, but there's some truth to that, right? You know, you live for years and years and tens of millions of dollars in ad revenue rolled in every year. And now not so much.
To be honest, I think there is a discipline in the print medium that isn't there in the digital medium.
Absolutely.
Mark Will Weber, my first editor, he said, you have 3,300 characters. I don't care if it's three words, it's 3,300 characters. And so I had to discipline myself. I mean, if I was up to 2,500 characters or more, and I had to wrap it up, or I had to go back and cut it. And then, as you know, now I submit the words and it goes into the big meeting. And now the art guy says, oh no, I've got a piece of art.
Yes.
Giant. So you need to cut this down to eight words. You know, I ran Chicago Marathon. That's it. Because the art's got to be that big. So now in the print medium, there's this conversation going on and the balance between print, words, art, all of that kind of stuff. And I, you know, people will say, hey, I want to get a career. I want to start doing this. And here's my blog. Would you read my blog? And they'll do a blog that's 60,000 words. No, nobody's going to read. They think it's interesting. and maybe some of their family or dog thinks it's interesting, but that's, and I don't mean to be critical, I'm just saying that I had to learn very quickly the discipline of writing in a print medium.
Well, and there's also, of course, today it's even worse in that everything is fed in just bite-sized nuggets, right? People want to consume something in 15 seconds and that's it. I'm flipping through an Instagram feed or Facebook feed or even looking at headlines online for whatever publication I like to go to. People, you know, all of our brains, I'm guilty of it. All of our brains are, nobody's reading, or a lot fewer people are reading, 20,000 word newspaper, New York Times Magazine style pieces anymore, right? That's kind of gone.
So that's a really interesting point, because that's actually sort of the next phase of this, was it's that whole clickbait. Now, when you're a storyteller like I am, I don't know how you could come up with clickbait. What am I going to put for clickbait? Right? These are stories. I mean, they're Garrison Keillor kind of things where they take a little while to unwind. And so, yeah, I think for somebody today, they got to be able to come up with that clickbait. They got to come up with that headline or that one thing that, whether it's true or not, doesn't matter, right? You know, I ran a 6-minute mile today. How to run a 6-minute mile? And then you open the column up and it's like, I have no idea how to run a 6-minute mile, but you got the person there, right? That's what counts.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone's ever observed this before. Your stuff kind of reminds me a little bit of Bill Bryson, A Walk in the Woods. I don't know if you ever read that book about the guy.
No.
It's great. I think you'd love it. It's about a guy who's kind of out of shape and not really an outdoorsy guy, decides he wants to hike the Appalachian Trail.
What's the name?
Bill Bryson is the author. It's called A Walk in the Woods, and really funny stuff. It's, yeah.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
No, it's he sold a zillion copies and all that stuff. It's probably 10 or 15 years old at least now, but similar, he's got a similar tone and similar sense of humor to what you have. So, that's maybe if your motorcycle columnist doesn't write you back still, Bryson will send you a note, giving you an attaboy.
It's the first book, which was The Courage to Start, is still in publication, and it's just amazing to me. It was written in 1997 and published in 1999. And yet there's still something in that for some reason, again, resonates with people. There's something in that that says, oh, I need to read that. Because I'm sure Simon and Schuster would love to just stop doing that. Resonates, or apropos to what you just said, the digital copies of those books, all of the books, selling 3 or 4 times what the print
copy. So, all right. So you have to be a little immodest here. So you've sold a bunch of books. I know you're humble about your running prowess or lack thereof, but what do those numbers look like? These have been really, really popular publications.
Yeah, they have. And I don't really keep that close to track. I mean, I think Courage to Start, the first one's probably sold 250,000 books or more,
amazing.
That kind of thing. And the other ones kind of fall in there somewhere. So, I mean, all total, and again, it's not a matter of braggadocio, that just happens, right? I mean, so all of a sudden you think, geez, I've sold 500,000 books. Now, Hillary Clinton will sell 500,000 books in the first hour, right? So, but I look back at the Sheehan years, and Sheehan, when I first started all this, that said, if he could sell 5,000 books a year, that would be a really, really good year.
Sheehan said that to you?
Yeah, well, Sheehan didn't. He was dead before I got in there. But they were talking about the volume of
books
that were being sold. They said, look, because I'm looking at them, and you sold 15,000 books or something like that in a year. And I thought, well, this is terrible. No, some of the best-selling running books were only selling 5,000 copies a year. So the books were selling in the second generation of running people were there, and they were buying books. And they were buying magazines, they were buying books, they were buying T-shirts for my mother. So it all kind of came together.
So that's why you've not been on a commercial flight, strictly your private jet for the last 10 years.
Jeez. Oh, you know better than that. I still get my royalty statements. And I remember what my book agent, I did have a book agent, said, yeah, we're going to sell this. And this is probably going to generate $30,000 to $40,000 in income a year. And whoa, sign me. And I think the biggest year and I'm just being honest about this, I think the big year, it was $3,700. And like, oh, wow. Don't spend it all in one place.
Yeah, baby.
Don't get rich writing books.
Beers on the Penguin.
Yeah.
All right. So you've been a great sport. We'll hit you with a couple quick rapid fire questions. We've hit a bunch of other guests with, and we've gotten some really interesting results out of this. So we'll, if you indulge us, we'll try to get a more clear picture into your soul here, into the penguin. Favorite movie of all time?
Blazing Saddles.
Oh, no one said that. Now there's a movie that probably could not be produced and released today.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely.
But it is Irreverence.
Would be on that list too.
Oh yeah. That's great. History of the world, all that stuff. Yeah. That was a great era. Favorite book, not allowed to say one of your own.
I probably haven't read a book in so long. I don't know. I mean, you have to go back to something like She and Running and Being or something like that, that it was really influential. I'm dyslexic, so reading for me is not a sport that I enjoy.
Totally fair. But those are, but you still enjoyed those, the running classics, some of that how-to stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Great stuff. Morning runner, midday runner, evening runner.
Evening runner.
Yeah.
I used to reward myself after work by going for a run. And then I could kind of put aside all the nonsense of the day and get ready for dinner and sort of enjoy my life.
Run with headphones, not headphones.
No, don't like to run with headphones. Or if I'm not getting paid, don't like to run with anybody else.
I'm with you, man. Most people like to run in a group, like to run in the morning, like to run with something in their ears. You and I are 3 for 3 on the opposite of that one.
It's the motorcycling thing. I put a helmet on. That's it. I'm there. I'm inside my helmet. And when I'm running, I don't have the helmet on, but I'm still inside my head. And that's all. I don't want to hear about somebody's dog or their husband.
I hear you. Best mentor in your career?
Oh, yeah. Get a mentor. Absolutely. Hal Higdon.
Really?
He was the mentor in one conversation. And that was all it took. But I mean, I've known Al for a long time now. And he just said, you know, just come into this business quietly. Hmm. Just come into it quietly. Because you don't know who anybody is and you don't know what they're up to. And he didn't mean it in a negative way. But just, you know, I'm fairly enthusiastic and evangelical about this. And he just said, no, just let it kind of work itself in organically. And it was great advice.
Very interesting. If you could have dinner with one person, living or deceased, who would it be?
Oh, Steve Jobs.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what he was going to come up with next, because I think we're sort of stalled on all of that.
Right. That's a great point. That's a great one. No one said that. Speaking of Steve Jobs, if you ruled the world, which you will one day, John, would you?
I am retired, buddy. I mean, I'm glad to be retired.
Would you, do you think it's, are you glad the iPhone was invented, or would you say, hey, it's done more harm than good and rewind and get rid of the iPhone?
No. I mean, clearly it's done a lot of great things. I mean, you know, right now with the whole telehealth and all that kind of stuff, it's
good point.
Really great things that it's done. I mean, I grew up with a party line where I have to ask Mrs. Peluso to get
Remember
off
that?
The line so I could call a friend of mine. I'm talking to my sister. Well, Mrs. Peluso, I really need to call, you know. So yeah, I'm all for the iPhone.
All right. So yeah, I have teenage kids. I'm, you know, Brad and I both have teenage kids. We're ready to strangle them because they can't answer us without looking at their phone first. So.
Well, I mean, I have teenage grandchildren and it's the same thing. And they'll FaceTime you. And it's like, I had to have my granddaughter, this is never number of years ago now, show me how to turn on the speaker of my iPhone so that everybody in the car could hear. So I'm not a big technology guy.
So it's not on my list of rapid fire questions, but I'm really intrigued by, so you mentioned that you're dyslexic. As you know, a lot of dyslexic people are actually super high achievers. How's that affected your life positively, negatively?
Well, I think in the early stages it affected it negatively. I mean, I started elementary school in the early 50s, 53, 54, something like that. And then if you were dyslexic, you just weren't paying attention. You got to focus, but I'd hear a car go by and then that would distract me. And then the teacher would say, well, this is how you do this. And I would miss it completely.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, school was a struggle for me all the way up, not to believe it or not, all the way up until my doctorate. And in my doctorate, one of my colleagues was doing an eye movement test that was part of his research. And so I got tested. Turns out my eyeballs do this. They're not linear. So
wow.
As a musician, it was the greatest thing I could have possibly had, because I would see key signatures and timing. I could see the whole page of music and assemble it, rather than somebody who would read the music one line at a time. Oh, geez, time changed here. So at that point, as I'm in my early 30s, I realized this is an advantage. If I take advantage of this,
yes,
this would be a good thing. And so the idea of being able to kind of be creative with that, rather than thinking, oh, geez, I mean, I'm dumb. Because in those, you know, 50s and 60s, you were dumb if you couldn't get straight A's.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, I think it was, as it turns out, it was a blessing that I didn't know I had.
The Penguin, the legend.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Thank you for making time for us. This is really cool. My only disappointment in the whole conversation is that the Penguin coffee mugs and t-shirts are not still available online. This is how I'm going to make my fortune. I'm going to buy the rights from you when you're least expecting it.
No, when my mother passed away, that was sort of the end of that era. We just let it go. That was fun. It was great fun. And people really like, and people still have them. I mean, people, every now and then they'll put it on their Facebook that they're drinking coffee out of a Penguin mug. Look, I mean, the way I want to end this is to help you guys understand that I am enormously grateful for the way my life has gone. I mean, I have people say, well, I didn't get what I deserved. I didn't get what I deserved either. It could have gone a lot of different ways. But the fact that it went this way, the fact that, you know, people like Tim Murphy and Andy Burfoot and all these others were willing to step in. Jeff Galloway was another guy that gave me a lot of opportunities. Without their help, none of this would have happened. You know, I'd have been still teaching school at Middle Tennessee State University, trying to get kids to learn about music. And that would not have been very much fun at this stage of my life. So eternally grateful to them and to the people that have really bought into it.
Well, look, I'm sure you've played the mentoring role 1,000 times over the last 20 years or so. And you just never know when something you said. So for instance, you mentioned, I think you said Hal Higdon gave you some great advice, but you just never know when a 13 second conversation is going to have a profound influence on someone.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. There are intersections that you don't even realize are important sometimes till years later. You know, somebody will come up to me at an expo and say, I read this that you wrote and that changed my life. Well, you know, that's a gift to me. The best part is, just to end it, is that the people who come up to me and say, you know, I know exactly what you were talking about. And then they'll tell me about a column and exactly what, and I'm like, oh, that's very insightful. No, very few people really caught that, the nuance of all that. I turn around, well, it wasn't what it was at all, right? But they brought that to it. It doesn't matter. And that's one of the things I've learned about writers, is that you can't really read it without bringing your own stuff to it. And nobody reads it as a blank page. You bring whatever you can. So yeah, it's been, all of that's been a joy. Never, never was a problem.
Absolutely. Hey, great stuff. We can't thank you enough, John. You're great to put up with us and really good insights. I know our listeners are going to get a big kick out of this one.